Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, a conversation about the work, lives and legacy of the Impressionists. This is an episode of Sotheby's Talks, the podcast series that takes listeners inside the world of Sotheby's. To listen to more episodes of Sotheby's Talks, featuring the likes of Marina Abramovich, Mary McCartney, Paloma Picasso, Tracy Emin, Julianne Moore, Celeste and Helen Fielding, just search Sotheby's Talks wherever you get your podcasts.
For almost three centuries, Sotheby's has been the place to discover the greatest stories of creativity. We look after some of the world's finest treasures, which you can see in our galleries on any given day. Welcome to Sotheby's Talks, the podcast that celebrates art, culture, and collecting. My name is Simon Shaw, and I want to invite you inside the world of Sotheby's, where you can find the extraordinary, from contemporary art, master paintings, to rare books, jewellery, and memorabilia. I'm Vice Chair of Sotheby's Fine Arts Division, and during my 28-year tenure here, I've championed Impressionist and modern art, setting new benchmarks for artists including Monet, Magritte, Munch, Giacometti, and Kandinsky. On this podcast, the first in a new series focused on legacy, we're sharing some of the conversations we've been holding with our experts, along with the descendants of artists who shaped the history of art. In this episode, Helena Newman, Chairman of Sotheby's Europe, is joined by Paul Signac's great-granddaughter Charlotte Hellman, photographer Eric Madigan Heck, and the National Gallery's Chris Riopel for a conversation about the revolutionary impact made by the Impressionists. These groundbreaking artists, Monet, Renoir, Degas, Bizarro, and others, defied academic norms by their use of loose brushstrokes, a focus on light, and an emphasis on everyday modern life. They changed art forever, and their influence can be seen in the work of artists like Seurat, Van Gogh, Degas, the Cubists, and the Abstract Expressionists. This podcast was recorded at Sotheby's in London to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Impressionism. Here's Helena with more.
We're really, really delighted to have you this evening for this discussion with a wonderful panel to celebrate 150 years of Impressionism and its legacy. We're very, very excited actually to explore this topic of Impressionism, its significance, which is still so relevant today. So for this conversation, we have a wonderful panel for you here tonight. Chris Riopel from the National Gallery. He is the Neil Westry Curator of post-1800 paintings at the National Gallery. Thank you so much, Chris, for being with us here tonight. We're absolutely honoured to have you. Chris co-curated the exhibition that many of you may have seen last year, After Impressionism, Inventing the Modern Art, and also curated a wonderful show in 2015, Inventing Impressionism, all around the story of Durand-Ruel, the dealer. And we're looking forward, Chris, to your show, Van Gogh, Poets and Lovers, which opens here in London at the National Gallery, coinciding with their 200th year anniversary later this year. We have Charlotte Elman Cachin, the great-granddaughter of the neo-impressionist Paul Signac. Charlotte curated the exhibition Signac, the Collector, at the Musée d'Orsay in 2021 and published the Signac Diaries, and is director of the Signac Archives, and is working on the catalogue Resonate. And then, thank you, Charlotte, thank you for coming from Paris today. And then to give a kind of contemporary voice to this conversation, we are joined by the artist, Eric Madigan Heck. Thank you very much, award-winning artist, working in photography, painting and film. And you've had solo museum exhibitions at the Musée des Beaux-Arts in Le Locle, Switzerland, and the Multimedia Arts Museum in Moscow, Russia. And you're also a writer, publisher, focusing actually on the influence of art on the history of fashion. So for each of you, a quick, short kickoff question just to get going. And we'll start with Christopher. Why is Impressionism so important to you?
For me, it is very important because, as I discovered when I was young, starting out on a career, that it is the first moment in modern history where artists understand things have changed. They have to be in control of their own careers. They have to be in control of how they're seen, who they're seen by, how they're spoken about, and take charge.
Thank you. Eric?
For me, I grew up with a mother who was an Impressionist painter. I was making the joke that she was not from the 1800s, but my earliest childhood memories are of seeing the world through Impressionist paintings around me.
Yeah. And yes. Charlotte, what about you? When did you realize Impressionism was so important?
When I realized how train stations were important and how modern they were. Because when you think about it, at that time, a train station was so, I mean, it talked about modernity in every way, in the architecture, but also in what happened, bringing in and out of the city masses of people. And that was so new. And I realized that painting a station at that moment was really revolutionary. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, a lovely segue into the first question for Chris. Thank you, Charlotte, which is why Impressionism was so revolutionary. Tell us a bit about the emergence of Impressionism and that kind of revolutionary moment.
Well, the event that we're celebrating is the 150th anniversary of that first exhibition in April of 1874, when the artists came together, asked their friend, the photographer Nadar, could they have a space in his very, very successful photography studio and mount an exhibition here. Famously, Monet showed this picture, Impression Sunrise, the work from which the movement took its name. We're often told, even to this day, that it was a sarcasm, satire on the part of a critic to call this movement Impressionism. He himself called picture Impressionism. Widely old Monet fed a soundbite to a journalist, and the journalist took it up and said exactly what Monet wanted him to say about it. It's shocking, but it still happens today.
Yeah, no, I think many of us in this room have been taught art history that way around, so thank you for correcting us. Yes. But tell us a bit about that moment in the 1870s, because Monet had just returned from London, hadn't he?
Yes. Let me say quickly, on the second exhibition in 76, this is the picture that really frustrated the critics with the light coming down through the trees. They said it looked like decomposing flesh. and this was where the agitation really began between the more traditional critics and the new audience that was, in fact, quickly building up for this new kind of painting. But in fact, key moments were in London. In 1870-71, the artists fleeing the Franco-Prussian War came here, Daubigny, but most importantly, Monet and Pizarro, and so did the dealer Paul Durand-Ruel. And it is, this we should remember, it is in London that Paul Durand-Ruel meets both Monet and Pizarro. Monet drops by with this picture to show it to a gallery Durand-Ruel had rented on Bond Street.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Leaves this picture because Durand-Ruel is not there at that moment. Durand-Ruel realizes this is something extraordinarily new that amazingly, he had not seen in Paris, and goes and finds Monet and buys the first pictures from him and then from Pizarro here in London. And it is here within blocks that he decides he has to do something about this new movement he's seeing.
It's fascinating.
And it's also in London, because he then starts bringing, Durand Royal starts bringing over pictures. It's here in London that the first and most important works are sold. But the key figure, and I keep coming back to him, is Paul Durand Royal, who takes up one after the other of the artists. Among those he first meets when he goes back is, of course, Renoir. He understands the important role that Renoir plays in works like his various dancers in establishing a connection between a new kind of painting, a new way of painting, and old, very French traditions. Dancing, elegance, the fête galante. He brings it into the 19th century as a part of modernism. And he is perhaps one of the most important in forging a way into this new art being understood. Dugatou, one of the most important exhibitions, the greatest exhibition of Impressionist art ever seen in the world, takes place here in London in 1905, again, three blocks away in Grafton Street, when Durand Ruel brings it. Only 13 pictures are sold in that, none to a British buyer.
It was in London. You have to count that.
It was absolutely.
I mean, because we always think about, you know, Impressionism going to New York with Durand Ruel and being, you know, taking the artist there. But actually, the 1905 Grafton Gallery show was extraordinary avant-garde for the time.
Yes, absolutely. This picture was proposed for, this is a shameful moment, I have to tell you, proposed for to be bought for the National Gallery by public subscription. And the National Gallery trustees preempted this by saying we would not have a Monet in the National Gallery. Again, we come back to this man, Durand Ruel, who was one of the first lifestyle dealers, because he had his gallery. But he also had this apartment on the Rue de Rome. This is a family apartment. You could go there if you were a good client or if he thought you might be and see the way his family lived with Renoir's, with Monet's. All those doors that you see in that room are decorated by Monet with flower pictures. A typical haute bourgeois French context. So you didn't have to worry about buying these modern pictures. This was particularly true when his great friend, the American Mary Cassatt, brought Americans to see, this is how you can live with this art.
Well, and so many of these pictures ended up in American collections, didn't they? Because of Durand Ruel doing the shows there, and also because it was so difficult in Paris at that time. I mean, a lot of them were not well received, were they?
No, not at first. There was a certain hostility or a want for tradition. Durand Ruel went bankrupt three times, but finally he said, America saved me. And it was because the Americans began to buy and the broader Europeans began to buy as well, even more quickly than in Paris.
It's an amazing moment, really, that explosion. Yeah. And so many works now in the American museums come from that period of acquisitions. But I think if we, you know, if we talk about the reaction to Impressionism, and obviously there was the hostility at the beginning and the shock, we're all so used to it now, but it did really kick off an amazing moment across Europe in modern art. And I think your show, Chris, that you did last year, After Impressionism, Inventing Modern Art, is really the kind of, really brings that all together from each country, whether it is in what was going on in Paris, of course, but also in Vienna and in Brussels, and really these threads of this creative explosion across Europe. I think you've got essentially two threads, haven't you? You've got the one that through Cézanne, and moving on towards Cubism and directionally all around.
Yes, yes.
And then you've got everything around color. I mean, there are these two threads, aren't they, with Van Gogh, pointillism, neo-impressionism, as it's also called, and then the Fauves. So, I mean, it's an extraordinary moment, isn't it?
And what we see also there is one generation or half generation of French artists ready to take up and help along the next generation as they emerged on the scene, to show them how to work in this very complicated new market, how to present themselves as individuals.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And what a wonderful way to bring in Signac, because am I not right in saying that Signac was 17?
Yes.
When he met Monet?
Well, he was 17 when he met Monet's paintings. Ah. He went to see La Vie Moderne, the first show he saw of a solo show of Monet. And it was such a shock for him that he decided to become an impressionist painter when he was supposed to be an architect. And then at that moment, he was in, the last year of college and of high school. Mm. And he decided not even to take his baccalaureate, which would be like A-level today. Oh. And he said to his mother, I'm just not doing it. I'm going to be an impressionist. So, and then he wrote to Monet and said, look, I need advice because he took very, very few classes. He was totally a self-made painter, Signac, out of the bourgeoisie. So, you know, he didn't need the money, obviously. And he wrote to Monet and he said, I would love to meet you and I need advice. And Monet replied very kindly. And they met and they became friends. And that friendship, you know, remained all their life. I mean, all Monet's life. And it was very important. And Monet, as you said, that it's really beautiful that the way that Monet treated Signac, then Signac treated Matisse the same way. He became like an old, sort of old...
An éminence grise? No.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Because, then Signac, because he has his very strong personality and he was very generous. And at the end of his life, because he was at the head of the Salon des Indépendants, which was a huge thing, he would meet all the new young painters and he would host them in his house in the south of France or in Paris, and he would play the part that Monet or Pissarro played with him.
Mm.
Even with the Fauves, I mean Matisse, Durin, Matisse and Marquet especially.
Mm. So with the Signac,
You can see this is typical, a very Monet-y way of painting. The four first years of his painting life were dedicated to Monet and Guillaumin and Degas, of course, which was the high admiration of Signac too. And when Signac is invited by Berthe Morisot, who she really is the one who went to see the youngsters, Signac and Seurat, and say, come with us. and Pissarro, of course. And it was a beautiful present that Pissarro and Morisot did to Signac and Seurat, because the 8th exhibition, the last Impressionist exhibition in 1886, I mean, if you look at the catalogue, it's impressive. You have the Grand Jatte and you have all the first pointiest neo-impressionist paintings by Signac. And it's a way for them of showing this new technique, but also to place themselves under the patronage of impressionists. So I think it's very moving. And La Neige, Boulevard de Clichy, it's the key moment, you know, when Signac turns from total impressionist painter to neo-impressionist. His technique changes very, very softly, though, but it was a very famously snowy winter, and he would take his first studio next Boulevard de Clichy, just next to Seurat, and so that's the moment, the painting that we consider the first pointiest technique.
I mean, I think this is quite interesting that, you know, we always think of the artists and what we know about the artists, but their political presence was quite important,
yes,
in France at that moment.
Yeah, that's also a very interesting moment in Impressionism and Neo-Impressionism, because we have this tragic Dreyfus case in France, which is going to divide the entire society for almost 15 years. And of course, in the field of art, it's very interesting, because it's a very clear division between, and it's not between Impressionist or Neo-Impressionist, not at all. It's between, because you have Monet and Signac and Pissarro on the same side, very close, the very first painters to sign this petition in favor of Dreyfus and Émile Zola. And then on the other side, you have Renoir, Forain, and Degas, of course. And that's a very interesting moment also, because you can see that the acquaintances between the painters, it's not only about the aesthetics, right? It's about also the freedom and equity, justice, and their vision of it.
And what about your great grandfather's private life? Because that wasn't that conventional, was it?
No, it wasn't conventional. And well, Signac was a very strong personality. He would be committed to everything, as well as a painter, a sailor, or in political movements, anarchism, and of course in his love life, he did things also in a strong way. He had two love in his life, two loves, a first wife and then a second woman. And when she got pregnant, he decided, well, he was very responsible, so he went to live with this lady. But he never divorced, and he managed to have his wife, his first wife, who he managed to be his best friend, and he managed to have her adopt the child that he had with the other woman. And without trying not to hurt everybody, which was quite a challange, and he finally made it.
And you're a descendant
of that woman.
Of
yes.
That woman. Well, I think it's all very French. That's all I can say.
Very French. My grandmother was a painter, Signac's daughter, and she was, I consider, a very good painter. And it's a shame, because her name was Signac, and that's like a curse for life, you know.
What was her first name?
Ginette.
Ginette Signac.
Yes. And then my mother was just, she was not a painter, she was an art historian, and she started the Catalogue Raisonné on Signac, which I now have the duty to numerize. How do you say? Yeah, numerize and redo, because it's 20 years old. So yes, she used to talk about it, but she didn't want to be too heavy, so it was kind of natural. And no, in fact, I didn't know when I began to be in charge of the archives out of duty. I really didn't know if I would really love that much. And then when I dived into it, I realized that he was really a nice person to be around. He's really a very interesting figure, not only because he was a painter, but because he was so committed, so passionate about everything. And he had, there's this huge correspondence, not only with the artist of his time, but all the politics and the writers. And so I think it's interesting now to see what is alongside the paintings and to publish all these writings and different correspondence.
Your mother had a formidable reputation. I was always a little bit scared of her. When I was a junior cataloguer, I had to write to her in French and ask for her opinion on a little watercolor by Signac. We were all quite daunted by her. You met her, didn't you, Chris?
Yes. She is the founding director of the Musée d'Orsay, which is, for us in our field, the mother of us all. We owe your mother a great dance.
Françoise Cachin. But I think it's not a linear story, this one we're trying to tell, of, you know, Impressionism, its legacy and the different strands and all these many, many, many different art movements and artists that came out of this. You know, if we look at Monet, for instance, with such a long, long career, and by the time you get to the late paintings, which are, you know, right through until, you know, 1920, that's, if you think at the same time, you've got, you know, it's already post-cubism, and Monet is still with his water lilies, but expanding the canvas onto these large-scale, large-format canvases that seem to, you know, set the scene for abstraction, almost for 20th century abstraction. They're becoming more and more loose, more and more just about color. And, you know, you think that that is in a way starting the route that will run through the whole 20th century with artists like Rothko, you know, really set the scene in a way for abstract expressionism. And some of you may have seen that fabulous show at Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris. I think it was last year, wasn't it, of Joe Mitchell with Monet. There was a wonderful dialogue of the artists across, you know, over half a century, but really drawing on that impressionist legacy, really, in terms of color and subject and form. But so many artists, I think Eric would say that even today, that Impressionism has been something that has really informed their taste and their style and their motivation to become artists in the first place. I mean, you talked about your mother who was an artist and she introduced you to Impressionists. You know, tell us a bit more about your art to this audience and also the influences, because it's so interesting to hear it, you know.
I relate to Impressionism not just for the end result or the aesthetic or the surface. Basically, I take photographs and I call them like destruction prints, because basically they're made over time, but also really quickly. So like this photograph, for example, which I took in Wales, you know, there's probably like 30 layers of color built on top, but in the same manner of like how the Impressionists painted, a lot of it is just very instinctual and very fast. So I might put a layer of red on top of the grass. The grass is obviously originally green. The early morning sun was as you see it, but I'll spend a lot of time building color on top in a sort of similar way, but also it's not preconceived. Every picture is kind of experimental. So by the time that I get done with it, it might be somewhere totally different than when it started. The photography is sort of chasing light, right? So that's why as a photographer, you're shooting early morning, late night to try to get those dramatic sunsets or like dramatic light going through the forest that casts shadows, etc. So, I mean, light used to be to me the most important thing, especially when you're shooting black and white, because it's purely compositional. But I think now I would say it's secondary to color. To me, color has become the sort of main character of the picture as opposed to the person in it.
But it's so interesting, Eric, you talk about, you know, the use of photography, because of course the Impressionists also used photography in a way for, if you think of Degas, you know, also to capture the moment and to...
I think the Impressionists used photography to then work from, and I used photography almost
as the end,
as an opposite. Yeah. In terms of, to me, the taking of a picture is just the sort of the groundwork. The final product never looks like the original negative, if you will. I can paint, but you don't want to. I mean, some of them are fine. But like, I always wanted to be a painter. My mother taught me how to paint, and she was great. And I was always very jealous. So I tried to figure out how to use photography as a way to make paintings. When you grow up with parents who show you Impressionism often and paint with you, all the sort of iconic Impressionist paintings get sort of locked into your mind as a kid. So you end up, you know, like none of these pictures I set out to make. Like you were saying with Joan Mitchell and Monet, you can go through art history and make these comparisons because we're always absorbing things around us.
It worked the other way as well, because the first Impressionist exhibition is in the studio of the great photographer Nadar, and they are choosing to say, look, we're as modern as photography. No, but that there is a synchronicity that they've always understood.
Well, I mean, I think for me, I photographed for 10 years of black and white. You know, I had a very conservative idea of what photography was. Like Bresson, I only used film, very street, cinematic, derivative, black and white French photographs. And then I was like, I really don't actually love photography. I love painting, but I don't want to spend all the time learning how to paint better. So let me try to figure out how to paint with photography. Yes. And I don't mean that in terms of the end result. Again, it's really the process, because the way that, even though it's digital oftentimes now in terms of layering color, it really is about an additive process, whereas photography inherently is reductive.
Yes.
You know, you're taking from the world, whereas painting, you're adding onto your canvas.
Well, I think before we conclude, I would like to thank our panelists, really, really, to Chris. We're looking forward to seeing the blockbuster Van Gogh show at the National Gallery, which opens on the 14th of September, Van Gogh Poets and Lovers. Eric, we're looking forward to your forthcoming book, The Tapestry, published by Thames and Hudson, hitting the bookshops in mid-September. And thank you so much, Charlotte, for coming over from Paris, telling us your personal stories and the stories of your great-grandfather, Signac. It's been absolutely wonderful to be joined by Christopher Riopel, Charlotte Elleman-Cachin, and Eric Madigan-Heck tonight. And thank you all for joining us.
This was Sotheby's Talks. Thank you for joining us. To step further into the world of Sotheby's, you can visit any of our galleries around the world. They're open to the public. For more information, visit sotheby's.com.
Thanks for listening. This was an episode of Sotheby's Talks from Sotheby's and Intelligence Squared. To listen to more episodes, just search Sotheby's Talks wherever you get your podcasts.